Vantline's President Raisi says Iran's maximum resistance has foiled Washington's maximum pressure, as evidenced by the U.S. officials' acknowledgement of the campaign's failure. The U.S. planning to deploy missile destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE a day after it fired Patriot interceptors to repel a Yemeni missile strike on the Persian Gulf state. And the U.K. says sanctions will come into force as soon as Moscow invades Ukraine, while the Russian president warns of U.S. attempts to drag his country into war. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Washington's policy of maximum pressure has failed to achieve its goals.
When the Americans openly acknowledge that they have failed in their maximum pressure policy, an ignominious failure, this is a victory for the Iranian nation.
Raisi said that Iran's policy of maximum resistance has offset the U.S. pressure. Raisi made the remarks during a visit to the mausoleum of the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Back in 2018, former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 deal between Iran and world powers and intensified a campaign of sanctions to force Tehran to negotiate a new agreement. Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with the 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been present at this year's ceremonies and filed this report.
43 years ago, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. Since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
With the United States growing more engaged in the war on Yemen, the Pentagon is preparing to send fifth-generation fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates in the wake of Yemeni strikes deep inside the Persian Gulf state. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says Washington will also deploy guided missile destroyer USS Cole to Abu Dhabi. The U.S. will continue to provide early warning intelligence to the UAE 2 days ago, Washington also intercepted a Yemeni projectile headed for the UAE. The Yemeni army has warned that it will continue to strike the Emirates as long as it keeps targeting Yemeni people. On Monday, Yemeni armed forces targeted a number of sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. The UAE is part of the Saudi coalition that has been waging a bloody war on Yemen for 7 years now. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed directly from the war or indirectly from hunger and disease. We reached out to political commentator Jason Unruh to hear his perspective on the latest warning the Yemeni army has given the United Arab Emirates. Here's what he had to tell us.
The UAE seems to be relatively good to go along with it, to give them whatever kind of support, at least political support to some degree, and I highly suspect material support in the background or whatever form that it might take, and that this, of course, would lead the Yemenis to bring the war to the UAE, as we have seen on at least one occasion, and then, you know, we're having them say that they're not afraid to strike out at basically anyone who's going to support the destruction of their country and the slaughter of their people. So maybe because I'm not really a war strategist kind of person, but it does seem like Saudi Arabia is looking for help. I mean, that at least that's how it appears to my eyes. I mean, that wasn't how it was done at the beginning, but this change has been made. So I think that it is a change to some degree, but exactly what it is probably only in the heads of the Saudi planners themselves.
And the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement says the U.S. and Israel are the real enemies of Muslims, exploiting divisions among the Muslim Ummah to achieve their goals. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the policy of the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia on Yemen is in line with Israeli's stance, as evidenced by a recent trip by Israel's president to the UAE. He noted that Saudi Arabia allowed a plane carrying the Israeli delegation to fly over the kingdom while it prevents Yemeni people from using their own airspace. He said Israel and its loyalists consider Yemeni people as their common enemy. Houthi slammed the Saudi-led coalition's recent airstrike on a prison in northern Yemen as a deliberate attempt to create a massacre. He said the coalition bombed the prison while the United Nations and other international bodies were aware of the location of the facility. The Turkish military pounding the positions of Kurdish militants in northern Iraq and Syria. The defense ministry says the airstrikes were carried out Tuesday against suspected bases of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, and the People's Protection Units, YPG, in Derik and Sinjar. The Iraqi Autonomous Kurdistan region says the attacks did leave casualties, but has not released the details. Turkey views PKK as a terrorist group and has carried out numerous attacks against the group. The PKK has bases and training camps in the Sinjar region of northern Iraq on a mountainous border with Turkey. Ankara also has a military presence in Syria, where it has seized swaths of land in military operations since 2016. Tensions over Ukraine are escalating, with Britain now warning that it will impose sanctions on Russia the moment it moves to invade its neighbor. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says it's vital for Russia to pull back its troops and choose diplomacy. He says any invasion would be a disaster. Johnson made the remarks during his visit to Ukraine, where he met with President Volodymyr Zelensky. The Ukrainian leader, for his part, said that Kiev would resist any incursion. The Western states, mainly the United States, continue to beat the drums of war, saying that Russia is preparing for military action against Ukraine, despite repeated denials by Moscow. Meantime, Russia is warning that the U.S. is seeking to drag it into a war.
The most important U.S. goal is to contain Russia. That's the thing. In this sense, Ukraine itself is just a tool to achieve this goal. This can be done in different ways. One of them is to draw us into some armed conflict.
Putin made the remarks during a joint press conference with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The Russian leader says it's wrong to allow one country to increase its security at the expense of another. Putin also accused the U.S. and its allies of ignoring proposals Moscow delivered to Washington for security guarantees over NATO's eastward expansion. Moscow denies the allegations of seeking a military conflict, saying it has mobilized troops on its borders for defense purposes in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. The Omicron variant of the coronavirus keeps surging across the world, and the Czech Republic is the latest country to report record daily cases. More than 57,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. The country's highest single daily tally so far, but officials say hospitalizations remain steady and well below the previous waves. Denmark is another European country with a daily average of around 50,000 infections. It's also the first country in the EU lifting all of the COVID-related restrictions. The World Health Organization, however, says these restrictions should be removed slowly and with caution. The world body is warning that many countries have not even yet experienced the peak of the Omicron variant. And the conclusions of a much-anticipated inquiry into allegations of parties held at the UK Prime Minister's office during lockdowns last year is finally out. Although published in its redacted form, the report has fueled anger among the public, political opposition, and members of Boris Johnson's own Conservative Party. Here's a report.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building in penitent mode, again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously.
What it would take for this Prime Minister to go, I don't know. If this doesn't get in his way, then God help us all, frankly, in terms of politics in this country.
People are sceptical, and I think a lot of people also kind of think with the police, you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he'd made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purizep, London.
At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the United States received threats of mass shootings and bombings. The threats in cities from Baltimore to New Orleans has forced authorities to enforce campus lockdowns. This coincides with the first day of the U.S. Black History Month. On Monday, a wave of similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools. The White House says it takes these threats, quote, incredibly seriously, but that they still don't know what has motivated the threats. Last year, the U.S. intelligence services warned that racially motivated violent extremists such as white supremacists would seek to carry out mass casualty attacks in the country. Colin Campbell says a surge in threats against black Americans happens periodically in the country. He says this has its roots in some white Americans being dissatisfied with advancements of black people.
We're in a political climate where we've seen the increase of white hegemons that want to control the future of America and its separation of races, where there would be some of an apartheid dynamic and giving deference of one race over another. We're also seeing a divided political country as well. And each generation, or every several years, there needs to be a major fight in order for black Americans to win equality and equity in the country. And now at a time when we're starting to see strides happening with more educated black Americans, black women are the most educated ethnic group in our country. When we're seeing these strides, we are also seeing a commensurate white lash that we have seen historically whenever black Americans increase their autonomy, increase their agency, and increase their socioeconomic mobility.
Washington is considering strengthening its military foothold on the African continent in an apparent bid to counter the growing influence of its strategic rivals, Russia and China. That has raised concerns considering America's track record in countries which house its military bases. With over 20 years of military presence, the U.S. has not only failed to combat extremists and terrorists, but has also been involved in coups and overthrowing of several governments. Let's have a look.
Back in 2013, when AFRICOM was first established, only two African countries showed a willingness to host American bases. But now, even South Africa, which once led a campaign against American intervention on the continent, has hosted drills with the US. But that's a cause of concern, particularly considering the spike in coup attempts in West and East Africa, areas that host the largest concentration of US bases. At least seven coups over the past 13 years have reportedly involved troops trained under AFRICOM. Last week, a Pentagon report suggested a 70% annual increase in violent events linked to militant groups in the Sahel region. According to the data, last year, attacks across the region jumped from 1,180 to at least 2,005, the most dramatic hike on the continent. Those attacks have killed an estimated 4,800 people last year, accounting for some two-thirds of the total number of terror attack victims in Africa. The U.S. maintains its military presence in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but human rights groups say civilians have been caught in the crossfire and casualties from U.S. airstrikes are higher than have been reported.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Islamic Revolution as role model for Islamic movements. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. In the second episode of this series, you're going to hear on the role of the Islamic Revolution in formation of Islamic movements in the region. Stay tuned, please. The 20th century was the century of wars, which were mainly waged by the countries seeking power and subjugation of poor nations. The First World War broke out in 1914 and lasted for 4 years, killing millions of innocent people and devastating many cities and countries. This war set the ground for colonization of the Islamic countries by Western states, mainly Britain and France. Egypt, with its geostrategic situation in the region, was subjugated as a British colony. It was in the same years that Britain issued Balfour Declaration, which was indeed the prelude for fabrication and implantation of the Zionist regime in the heart of the Islamic nations. Although Iran had no role in the outbreak and spread of the war due to its strategic situation and the incompetence and servility of its shahs, turned into the road for commutation of Russian and British military. Hence, Iran was illegally occupied by the British forces till the end of the war in 1918. 21 years later, the Second World War broke out, which lasted for 6 years and resulted in coming to power of Russia and the United States of America as the two superpowers of the world. Again, the share of the Muslim nations was famine, disease, devastation of all infrastructures, pillage of resources, and colonization. The unwanted presence of foreigners in the Islamic countries urged many groups and establishments to come to existence, which sought to save their nations from various imported isms like Marxism, socialism, liberalism, and so on. Most of these groups and establishments were led by religious figures and reformists. Sayyid Jamaluddin Asadabadi was among these figures. He traveled to different Islamic and European countries and tried to impact people from various walks of life. Therefore, colonialists expelled him from Egypt and dissolved his party. Asadabadi was influenced by Shia ulema in Iran and Iraq. In 1952, Jamal Abdel Nasser annulled the royal government through a military coup and continued his struggles against colonialism. Yet his movement was deviated due to excessive pan-Arabic ideas and socialist proclivity in economy. In 1948, concurrent with the invasion of the global Zionism into Palestine and massacre of the children of the land by invaders, Muslims tried to repel the invasion. However, the servility, vassalage, and passivity of Arab governments left no ability and motive for them to defend the Holy Land. In 1967, Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, and Syria were allied to destroy the fabricated regime called Israel. Yet, they were badly defeated in a matter of just 6 days. This scandalous defeat set the stage for the decline of Abdel Nasser and turned down many Muslims across the world. In the midst of these events, a great clergyman from the Iranian city of Qom started his worldwide revolution to defend the integrity of Islamic values against the entire world of arrogance, Zionism, and colonialism. He was none but Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini, who soon became known as Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini had studied in Qom and obtained the degree of Ijtihad, that is, independent perception of Islamic sciences through the Quran and the words of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, in the age of 27. Thus, in addition to education, offering books and training students, he was struggling against the domestic tyranny and foreign colonialism. According to the Quran and the words of the prophets and the infallible imams, this great leader believed that selfishness and giving up uprising for God's sake were the main causes of Muslim nations' misery and dominance of the global arrogance and Zionism. He raised progressive doctrine of velayat-e-faqih, meaning rule of the supreme jurisprudent, as the key to victory over enemies of Islam. This jurisprudent should have a very deep knowledge of the Islamic sciences and should be the bravest clergy who is also well aware of the developments of the time. After the six-year war of Arabs against Israel, Imam Khomeini issued a fatwa whereby he declared as haram or religiously forbidden any commercial and political relation with Israel and consumption of Israeli goods. He also issued another fatwa in which he clearly permitted spending alms and zakat for Palestinian combatants. The Iranian nation's struggles against the Pahlavi regime yielded fruit in February 12, 1979, under the leadership of Imam Khomeini. This unmatched event of the 20th century was a beacon of light in the hearts of the world Muslims who had lost hope in salvaging from the clutches of tyranny and colonialism. The Islamic Revolution restored the lost identity of Muslims so that they boasted of being Muslim. Lebanese Shia Muslims considered Imam Khomeini as their leader and built up a strong group called Hezbollah, which has turned into the pain in the neck for Israel and is going to exterminate this cancerous tumor for good. The Palestinian Sunni brothers too loved Imam Khomeini and followed his teachings as the way of liberation of Palestine. The Islamic Iran didn't give up supporting the Palestinian oppressed nation even during the tough conditions of the all-out 8-year imposed war in 1980s. The war ended with the defeat of the superpowers, and the invading Saddam couldn't achieve any of his pre-planned goals of invading Iran. Iran turned into a role model for other Islamic nations who seek freedom and justice. While Western hired political analysts keep prophesizing the Islamic Revolution's imminent collapse, this greatest phenomenon of the 20th century continues advancing towards its lofty goals under the leadership of Imam Khomeini's successor, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Imam Khomeini's progressive and freedom-inducing ideas have transcended borders and have captured hearts and minds, even in Washington and London. The Islamic Revolution's victory under the unique leadership of Imam Khomeini had a number of ideals, including justice and freedom from the yoke of tyrannical regimes and foreign dominance. But these ideals were not restricted to Islamic countries, as for the recent years, we have been witness to Occupy Wall Street movement in the US and Yellow Vest in France, which mainly fights capitalism and seek justice. This is the meaning of explosion of light, as the Islamic Revolution was called by Imam Khomeini. He opened the way of a struggling against all excessive demands of big powers, particularly the US and the illegitimate Zionist regime. The Imam taught us to be steadfast and perseverant in the way of Allah and put our trust in Allah till our last breath and the last drop of our blood. We will never forget Imam Khomeini's heritage and will march in unity with other Muslim nations under the leadership of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
It's the 10-day festivities in Iran marking the victory of Islamic Revolution 43 years ago. The country has been through thick and thin in the past four decades, facing an imposed war and most cruel sanctions ever imposed on any country in the world. Now, among the accomplishments of the revolution, as Iran's leader has put, mention can be made of achieving independence, safeguarding the country's territorial integrity, the elevation of Iran's status on the international scale, the promulgation of free thinking, and the growth of spirituality.
43 years ago, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe-i Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals, no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum, where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests for this edition. We'll have Abulfaz Sajidi, Islamic Studies researcher in the Iranian city of Qom. Also joining us in this edition will be Masoud Shajar, the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Let me start with Mr. Sajidi. First things first, let's begin with a look at the roots of the Islamic Revolution in Iran and how it all began. Let our viewers know, what was it that made Iranian people to stand up and topple the Pahlavi regime?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Congratulations on the anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution of Iran and the arrival of Imam Khomeini in Iran. The root of revolution is value and Islamic understanding. People in Iran were under the pressure of injustice from Pahlavi regime, who was under the control of USA. You know, as previously, we see that always USA and some foreign countries, they wanted to use Iran for their own benefit. And because of that, we see in Iran, Imam Khomeini started to give enough information to people to understand what is the value of justice, what is the value of morality, because of, on the one hand, they had under the pressure of economical pressure, political pressure, and on the other hand, they saw that Islamic ruling are not applied in the society, rather they are not free to apply them, they are not free to even, they have their own ceremony. The politicians, they were rising, and because of that, they saw that even for the Muharram, they were not free to do their ceremony. So these various aspects of these attacks against Muslims and against this community, Muslim community, so we see that Imam Khomeini started saying that we should be a free country, we should use our own benefit, our own economic, we should make our economic, we should try to develop our country, to use our youth and every capital that we have for our own benefit. So because of these limitations, because of these problems that they had, they started to have the revolution. We see, because of that, actually, if we want to analyze our Islamic revolution right now, if we want, we must examine Iran with the condition of the external enemies and the internal companions of those enemies. So, even at that time, and also still, we see the continuation of those unfair and ruthless activities. Right now, unfortunately, still we have an unfair and ruthless enemies. So if we want to analyze our revolution and we are to understand what we have obtained through this revolution, first,
Understand. Mr. Sajidi, sorry. Let's come to that point at a later time. You just start about the roots, and then we'll go ahead chronologically. Sorry for the interruption. Mr. Shajareh, one major achievement of Iran's Islamic Revolution was gaining true independence from all others and trying to stand on its own feet in the presence of myriad of plots and conspiracies coming its way. Don't you agree?
Absolutely. I think at the heart of the revolution was to free the nation and its population from colonial sort of interest and oppression, which was done through agents like Shah. You know, very much like what is happening now in the region, in Saudi Arabia, in Emirates. You know, individual dictators are doing the bidding of the colonial powers and oppressors for their interest and undermining the interests of their own citizens. This was a revolution to free and give independence and give people power back to the people with and through Islamic understanding. In some ways, it was also revival of Islam and Islam-e-Muhammadi as a sort of concept which liberating the people, empowering people, and indeed dictating and facilitating political, social, economical aspect. You know, let us remember, before the Islamic Revolution, Islam was being seen as an outdated ideology which only belongs to the past. What happened at the time of revolution wasn't what happened just in Iran, but right across the globe there was a tsunami of people an ideology to address the needs and aspiration, all needs and aspiration, political, economical, social needs of aspiration, not of just Muslims but others. In South America, people were carrying the pictures of Imam Khomeini and they were identifying with this uprising against the hegemony, US hegemony, which has been oppressing people.
Right.
And I think that is really, and Imam said very clearly, to be free, you first have to free your own mind. So decolonizing your mind, empowering, and indeed getting confidence to stand up for your principles was part of this revolution.
Okay. Now, Mr. Sajideh, let's now draw a comparison between Iran's Islamic Revolution and also the revolutions elsewhere in the world. What is it that makes Iran's Islamic Revolution distinct from other revolutions elsewhere?
Well, actually, there are various various differentiation we can make here. One is that Islamic Revolution was based on Islamic ideas. They wanted to be able to apply Islamic law in their societies. They want to achieve morality according to what Islam says. They want to achieve Islamic lifestyle. They want to have the culture, make their culture according to Islamic values. So one point is that this revolution is Islamic revolution. So because of that, Islam means that the culture, the economy, politics, and their social relations, families, education, all these aspects they wanted to base according to Islamic law and according to Islamic advices. According to Islam, we should, for example, prefer the spirituality over, for example, other aspects. So the spirituality and morality should be growth, we should have a kind of progress in this aspect. So one aspect is the Islamic aspect, and the most of values that we have in Islam, they are human values. There are not something different from others. Rather, according to Islam, we want to refer to our revelation We want to have our sample and our model, the Ahlul Bayt, Imams, the Holy Prophet, the Imam Hussein, Imam Mahdi, and all infallible Imams. So they are should be considered as our model. They are the person who has the best level of morality. So we want to have religion in our life, in the not only just once a month, for example, once a day we think for our relation to God. No, we want to bring God always to our society. So all right, our marriage, social contract, everything, they want to do it according to what Islam says.
Okay. Now, Mr. Shajar, as you know, Iran has been subject to severe Western sanctions all these years, that affecting all aspects of life. And still, lots of scientific and technological advancements have been made, for instance, in nuclear and nanotechnologies, among other things. So what's the secret for this success?
Well, the secret for success is independent, is empowerment, is liberation. And liberation in all aspects. You know, you were saying about different revolutions. Some revolutions was because of sort of reaction against class system. Some were for economical reasons. Islamic revolution was extremely balanced, and it was empowering all people. And, you know, after the revolution, the whole sort of direction of the society changed in such a way which has not been seen anywhere else. And it's that sort of aspect of it which empowered people to achieve all the achievements despite all the sanctions. I mean, really, to achieve what Iran has achieved technologically, it itself on its own is quite a sort of remarkable. But to do it despite all the sanctions, despite the fact that, you know, let's be clear, the whole world united against Iran. The imposed war of Iraq wasn't just Iraq imposing war. It was the whole world. All the Western and Eastern, the Arabs and everyone was involved in supporting Saddam. Despite all that, the victory came to the Iranian nation. And since then, with all the sanctions, as you said, you know, Iran has achieved in such a remarkable way that is really it's unbelievable. You know, in the field of education, in the field of empowerment of the women, there are more women in our universities as lecturers and scientists and professors than is in most of the Western world. You know, you could go through all the achievements in all different levels and you come to the only understanding that all this was as a result of people saying no to the colonialism of United States and neo-colonialism and getting independent and starting relying on themselves with the huge confidence which Islam has brought to them.
Right. Now, Mr. Sajidi, on the international front, Iran today is boasting of a lofty position and a status in the world, especially in the West Asia region, as a major player. It's offering assistance to regional countries like it helped Iraq defeat Daesh and others. Those countries are asking for it. Iran is offering them assistance. And Iran is also a source of inspiration for some other countries. Like Mr. Shadi just mentioned, Latin American countries. Let's have your thoughts on these aspects.
Yes. Actually, I think, you know, when we want to analyze Iran, we should understand the present situation and we should take into consideration the particular condition that we have. Yes, Iran, on the one hand, we had the Daesh, and Iran tried to remove this obstacle. But unfortunately, we see, for example, someone like Soleimani, the martyr Soleimani, has been We see the sanction of this ceremony on Instagram and all other mass media. So there is not a kind of justice in the world, unfortunately, against Iran. We see the chemical attack during the 8-year war. Right now we see that the vaccine and drug and medicine, they are the sanction of medicine, the sanction of drug, you know, the sanction of vaccine. These are not something understandable. How we can analyze them according to human understanding. You know, right now we see an extensive cultural war against Iran using cyberspace tools against Iran. We see in such a situation, actually we see that all countries, they are little to little, they are trying to understand Iran. I want to mention, when I was in Canada, there were mass media against Iran so heavy that once when I participated in a demonstration of votes in Canada, I saw one of my classmates who was in Canada, I saw that he also participated in the demonstration. I asked him that, what is the reason that you are participating in such a ceremony? He said, since I had tendency to understand political issues, when I saw that there are so many propaganda against Muslims, against Hezbollah, against Iran, I was sensitive to understand. Then I tried to discover, I understood that the truth is vice versa.
Okay.
So if they want to understand Iran also, they are trying to understand in such a way.
Right.
So we are not deep, it's such, we are not really, we are really, we should say that we are facing an unfair and ruthless enemy right now.
Okay. Now, Mr. Chandra, let's talk a little bit about the way that America has been treating Iran in all those years, since the very first day after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and cite reasons for Tehran having difficulty in trusting Washington's intentions.
Well, I think anywhere around the world, people should not trust U.S. intention. U.S. is a power, it's a hegemony that oppresses others for the benefit of not just Americans, but the benefit of few in America. I mean, let's face it, United States even oppresses its own people. When you have a situation that 1% of the population owns 85% of power, resources, and the wealth, that means that 99% are being oppressed by that 1%. And the system is geared, system has been fixed to enable this injustice to take place day in, day out. So, you know, the system in the United States, the legal system, the policing, all these structures are geared, are massaged, are actually created to create and continue that oppression of even Americans, majority Americans. When it comes outside of the United States, you know, they use the excuses of we want democracy, and then they promote the apartheid system of Israel, or the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia and UAE, when these guys are actually killing each other and their own family, imprisoning them, and there is no democracy, there is no justice.
Okay.
Really, I think I think Iran should be proud that has got United States as an opponent.
Okay.
And I think
we're out of time, unfortunately. I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. I apologize for that. Abulfaz Sajidi, Islamic Studies researcher, joined me from Guam, and Master Chajra, head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, with their contribution. So I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصارع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being. A brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام كفاك أدبا لنفسك اجتناب ما تكرهه من غيرك.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "It is enough for your own discipline that you abstain from what you dislike from others."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the things that we really should understand and appreciate is that a universal persona is a persona that an individual at any time or age or era can benefit from. So, for example, we've had personas whom for their own era and for their own age and time span, their words and their actions, they were appropriate. But when we're talking about a universal persona, we need to understand that this is a persona that despite the passing of time and despite the passing of